Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, just how unrepresentative is the American Congress? And first, what technological changes are needed to power the renewable revolution?
Sun-Young Kim is a political scientist at the University of Auckland. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you here with us. You've been studying the political economy of this new clean energy revolution that's happening, specifically with really the infrastructure, it sounds like, and what has to happen with the infrastructure for us to even have this. How would you help us understand what we've had and what we need?
Marie, that's a really interesting question because we talk a lot about this so-called global energy revolution, but the energy revolution cannot happen without the infrastructure to support it. So we have things like renewable energy technologies that are available, wind, solar being, you know, the leaders in this field. But we're not going to be able to actually use these renewable energies resources on a mass scale or very efficiently without something called the smart grid.
And why is that? What's wrong with the old grid?
The current power grid we have is over 60 years old. It was based upon using fossil fuels, based upon distributing and sending out electricity, based upon patterns from previous usage. So one of the big predictors of usage is based upon people using air conditioning, for example, in summer. So now the power producers can figure out that this much, that sector will require this much energy, and they'll send out the electricity. Then it gets distributed out. Now, the problem with this current power grid is that, one, it's very inefficient. You send out this mass amount of energy that doesn't always get used. Places where it does need it doesn't always get distributed out to that area, which is why you have things like blackouts. It's also based upon dirty energy, okay, brown energy, fossil fuel energy, that is. It's also incredibly inefficient. Imagine there's a world where people could start using energy based upon real-time pricing instead of using energy based upon what was sent out to you. Imagine you could use time when you want to use energy and certain products. If you want to, let's say, take a shower when hot water seems cheaper based upon energy prices at that certain point, wouldn't that be great, right? But the current power grid does not allow that kind of thing to happen.
So you're saying that moving into this new smart grid is really what would be the transition to being able to move to renewables. And is it because renewable energies are less consistent?
So smart grids, what it actually means is it's a concept still, but it refers to the digitization or the computerization of the current power grid. So you infuse the current power grid with things like sensors, with new types of software, new types of communication devices, essentially applying the internet to the power grid. And there are all sorts of different products and technologies that come about that are part of this power grid. But what it allows is that things like renewable energies right now are very intermittent. Solar and wind occur, they only produce energy at certain times.
Like when you've got sunshine or when you've
Absolutely.
Got wind, right?
Yeah. Now, how do we make use of this energy better? The first thing we actually need are mass energy storage systems, massive batteries which are already commercially available by firms like Panasonic and, of course, as I'll talk about later on, maybe like LG in South Korea. These types of technologies are all part of what we're calling smart grid technologies.
So the battery storage is part of this?
It's part of it. In order to use renewable energies much more efficiently, the smart grid essentially allows not only to use these technologies through energy storage, but also allowing what's called two-way communication. So by installing sensors and RFID devices along the electricity grid, those types of technologies allow continuous information back to what's called a total control center, a center which essentially monitors all the information coming in.
So let's talk about then what it takes to make something like this happen. One of the countries you and I have spoken about is Germany. So Germany has managed to do, I think, what is it, almost a third, something like 27% of its energy now is generated by solar and wind. And it's not exactly a sunny place. What had to be in place for Germany to get to that point? What do we have to learn from them?
Germans, through their, I think it's pronounced the Energiewende, right? Energiewende. So the energy transition that they started way back in the 70s. It's been a long historical process. Incidents like Chernobyl were some of the big major events which really pushed them to embrace this idea that nuclear isn't such a safe thing to use. And, you know, successive governments had differing policies towards the energy transition. But in 2011, it was the Merkel government, after witnessing the Fukushima nuclear disasters, which really pushed that her government into action by saying, we're going to shut down the nuclear energy reactors. And they did so very quickly. I mean, it's still ongoing, but
they have some left, right?
Absolutely. So they shut down something like 40% of the energy use that was coming out from nuclear reactors within the first 6 months, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong. And they have plans to shut all the nuclear reactors down by 2022, I think it is. But of course, we're going to see whether this is actually achievable or not, because as you might know, the old utilities have taken the German government to court. This is a very interesting battle. It's really one of the major battles in the developed world that we'll see between the old fossil fuel power interests and, of course, the new renewable energy business interests. So it's fascinating to watch.
I remember reading that in the German situation, nobody really expected it to take off in the way that it did. It happened sort of from a grassroots perspective. People, you know, created these community systems. And so it caught the big suppliers of utilities by surprise. So they really only have themselves to blame. But I understand some of them at least are trying to step up to the plate and incorporate renewable energies into their old models too. So that being the developed world, and then there's also the developing world and the big movers and shakers. I know one of the areas you've looked at is Korea and Korea's role with all this technology. I understand Korea is like way ahead of the game with this machines talking to machines, what people like to call the Internet of Things. Does this relate to these power grids and the new technologies that are necessary?
So I'll start with Internet of Things question. I mean, I met a researcher that works at the Electronic and Telecommunications Research Institute in South Korea. It's a big government-sponsored research institute. One of the researchers working on Internet of Things there, I remember I asked him, so what is Internet of Things? And he said, that's a good question. We're not really sure either. But, you know, I remember the one thing that he did mention is, yes, it's essentially about machines talking to machines, enabling automation on a whole new level, computerization. So, yeah. In that regard, you may say that the smart grid is an example of how Internet of Things can come into application, for sure.
And what is this compared to another area called microgrid? What's the microgrid?
I should go back then to answer your first part about what the South Koreans are doing. So South Korea is the most unlikely country to embrace anything like an energy transition. It's heavily wedded to the brown fossil fuels, simply because of the fact that this is a country which was late to embark on industrialization. It only really stepped onto industrialization in the 1960s after President Park Chung-hee came to power, you know, widely considered to be the father of South Korea's modern successful economy. And so because of the building up of these mass manufacturing industries, from steel to cars, from chemicals, all of these were heavily reliant on the cheap exploitation, essentially, of fossil fuels. In 2008, though, we saw the coming to power of a new president, President Lee Myung-bak, and he was the man who really had this vision, who are supported by people, key individuals such as Kim Sang-hyup, who was the presidential secretary for green growth, who really embraced this idea that green growth should be a national vision. Obviously a visionary man, he argued that South Korea could not only fight climate change, but really work towards ensuring its energy security and the creation of new export platforms through the idea that you invest into new green technologies, you use them, and then you sell them to the rest of the world. And of course, he called this green growth. So that's where South Korea came into this embrace of greening policies. Where does the smart grid come into this? Well, one of the big milestones of visions as part of his broad vision of moving Korea to a renewable energy footing was the smart grid, because you cannot have a renewable energy revolution without the smart grid. Smart grids are incredibly ambitious things. The technologies that are part of the smart grid are still in the infancy, I think it's fair to say. We have things like energy storage, like batteries. Big developments are happening, but they're still very expensive. Of course, things like Tesla have brought out this wonderful usable thing called a battery storage pack that you put in your garage. That's a wonderful idea, but it's still quite expensive. So there's the costing, but the actual technologies themselves are still in the infancy. So of course, we have things like the smart meters and that kind of thing, but other things like the distribution software, the devices needed to transform usable electricity from renewable energies back into the grid, the ability to sell back excess electricity.
Does that require the smart grid?
That's what the smart grid also involves. So the two-way communication thing allows things like electric vehicles, with, let's say they have solar panels stuck onto their roofs, right? Well, not all that energy is going to be used. Imagine that you could sell the electricity, excess electricity that a car doesn't use, back into the power grid. And in turn, the smart power grid then allows that energy to be diverted to people that actually need this.
Yeah, kind of like Germany was doing, and I think California embarked on, and Los Angeles.
Yeah, and so that's, so anyway, there are technological limitations to the smart grid being commercialized right now, but there are also political challenges, such as Germany's experience right now tells us, right? There's also
big businesses that don't want to lose their core source of money.
Absolutely. The old oligopolies, you know, they're not going to let go so easily. And this is where people like John Matthews argues that, you know, in his book, The Greening of Capitalism, where he argues that this is why a state-mandated transition is actually necessary as well. But going back to the question about microgrids, so smart grids are still a bit way off. There are some visions that say that the smart grid, such as one being developed in Korea, a fully commercial nationwide smart grid will be available by 2030, I think, just from memory. But one way to achieve that in the meantime is to develop things called microgrids. So microgrids are in many ways a part of or a stepping stone towards a full-blown smart grid. And a microgrids, there are two very different types. So one is one that's grid-connected to the grid. The other one is what you might call autonomous microgrids that can exist by themselves, that are separate from the power grid. So the perfect example would be the use of microgrids on islands, remote islands, which, and let me give an example of this. The South Koreans, about 2 years ago, successfully trialed a domestically developed microgrid developed by none other than the Korea Electric Power Corporation, which is the state-owned utility. Which has a monopoly over power generation. But it was this company which developed the microgrid, and it trialed it on an island called Kasa Island. It's an island with virtually nothing on it. But the island was being powered up by diesel. So what the government did to try to convince KEPCO itself, and indeed the companies that were involved in it, in this trial, of the virtues of this microgrid, not necessarily because they want to be seen as, you know, for the green credentials, but simply because of the fact that microgrids can deliver a cheaper cost for KEPCO.
So it is economically better.
Absolutely, yeah. So instead of using this old diesel power plants,
which are bad for everybody,
absolutely, you could install wind power, solar, you know, photovoltaic panels, and then to create a system that allows these islands like Kasa Island to essentially work by itself. You don't need this diesel engine. And that's what they did. It was a successful trial. One of the big things that's happened because of that is that the companies that were involved in the project, such as LSIS, I'm not sure if it was actually involved in the Kasa project, but anyway, KEPCO and other companies that were involved in it are now seeking export markets in places like Mozambique, in the Germans are interested in now in it as well, Southeast Asia. Well, there you go. This is the emergence of microgrids being developed around the world. You can imagine the applications for this all around the world, right? And it's just the one first stepping stone.
So was this like the first time that they've used this microgrid to power an entire island?
I'm not confident enough to be able to say yes on that, because there's a global, worldwide race to develop microgrids. And you can imagine one of the front runners are, of course, the US military, who have their own microgrid strategy. Not just the military, although the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST in the United States, has its own standard-setting initiative for microgrids. There are various companies that are developing this, in Japan as well.
Something about Indonesia.
Yeah, I think the Indonesians are hungry to get microgrids from the Koreans, as far as I know. But I'm not sure if they have their own program. But yeah, so I'm pretty sure that there must have been some trials elsewhere around the world, not just the Koreans. But what's so interesting about the Koreans is that they're already seeking to export these products. That's amazing. That really is amazing. So it tells us that the energy transition can happen, but it does require practical steps. And microgrids are the first step towards this smart grid, the key infrastructure that will enable a global energy transition. Without the smart grid, we're not going to have a transition.
I want to talk about the downsides in just a little bit. But before we go to the downsides, there are some, including, you know, jobs and the whole issues of privacy and all these concerns people have. But one of the things that you had been looking at, with specifically with South Korea as an example, is, you know, so they had resisted becoming part of the international agreements on climate and that sort of a thing. But then they made the transition and decided to go green and to try to become a leader in green. You thought that maybe we could predict, with this model that you used, what other countries might come to the fore. What do you think?
One of the things that my collaborator, Dr. Elizabeth Thurbon, and I argued in our paper that I think you're drawing the findings from in Politics and Society, we provide an analytical framework to try to explain why some countries are more likely to embrace what we call the philosophy underlying green growth, which we call developmental environmentalism. We try to provide a number of conditions. And the first thing we argue is that a country needs to be highly dependent on the import of fossil fuels. That's one of the first conditions. The second thing is,
so you're saying that if they are reliant on the importing of it, then they're more likely to then try to develop green technology.
Or at least embrace some sort of renewable energy.
So that they don't have to rely on other countries.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's an issue of energy security, not just climate change. The second condition that we try to specify is the existence of a centralized governance structure. And thirdly, related to that, of course, is a mindset of developmental environmentalism. So this developmental mindset, this strategic industry development focused mindset, which many people have referred to as the developmental state, made famous, of course, by Chalmers Johnson himself, pioneering work, meeting the Japanese miracle.
Rest in peace.
Absolutely. What a fantastic man and a big loss to the world. So those are the three main conditions we specify. So can those conditions predict, perhaps, why some countries will or will not embrace green growth? It's an interesting question. I don't have the full answer for it. But if we look at the United States, which is so dependent on, which has made some big announcements in the past, like by Obama himself, right? But the momentum for this shift towards a green energy footing really seems to depend heavily upon oil prices.
Right.
Right.
And given how much the United States is producing oil now,
absolutely,
it's not needing to import in the same way.
Absolutely. Whereas countries like China, which is heavily dependent on fossil fuels and also the importation of fossil fuels, countries like China, which also has a very centralized governance structure as well.
Do you see China becoming a leader in this?
Well, I think it's best to mention here John Matthews' work in Greening Capitalism. He argues that China is the world's leader in a new form of capitalism, a greener type of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And that it's important because China is one of the biggest carbon emitters
and users. Very polluted country.
Absolutely. Yeah. But that's the paradox. You look at China, you go to visit China, you see these black skies, but underlying all this stuff, it's actually the world's biggest investor into renewable energies, the most ambitious and aggressive user of renewable energies, simply because it needs to, for energy security reasons and for the ability to combat pollution as well.
If we talked about some of the downsides of the smart grids, and I mean, people are more concerned about the smart metering, of course, but the smart grids too, I wonder, first of all, you don't need people to go out and read meters anymore. So there's a question about losing jobs, right? So the economic aspect of that, and that's true of all things that we're turning to machines for, squeezing out people's jobs. There are other concerns too, such as cybersecurity, right?
Yeah.
Because it's all automated. And how easily would your energy get thwarted if somebody figured out your computer code? And then, of course, the third thing that we just sort of briefly talked about, which I don't have any answers for, the concerns people have about privacy and control and their power. Have there been discussions around solutions to these that you know of?
Oh, look, cybersecurity is one of the big things, isn't it? That's often discussed in relation to the Internet of Things, big data. These are the three things that are normally discussed together. You're right. Cybersecurity, ensuring that is going to be one of the big questions, not only for the smart grid, but as we enter a world of the Internet of Things. It's kind of scary in a way because, you know, all those movies such as, you know, the Terminator series, they predict a world where a software program can literally end the planet through controlling war, you know, guns and stuff like that. Well, yeah, I mean, we are kind of in many ways entering that kind of scenario. I'm not saying a nuclear holocaust, right, but we're talking about a world where computers play an increasingly important role, automation. And so, yeah, cybersecurity is going to be a big issue for the success of a smart grid. And you can bet that there will, of course, be breaches in the future once a smart grid is actually commercialized. And, you know, governments will be very interested in ensuring that we have preventative measures.
And in terms of economic concerns, green jobs, we talk about green jobs all the time, but in a way, moving to these computer systems, we also squeeze out jobs, right?
Yeah. Look, that's a big and important question. And I don't, of course, have the answer for it, but I'll just say two things. And I think there are two sides of the coin here. One thing is that, yes, it's true. You know, the greater automation, robotization of manufacturing and services, and the clearest example of this is someone that a technician that used to go do the readings for meters around power grids. Of course, that will all be automated with a smart grid. So yeah, there are obviously going to be challenges and old jobs will disappear. At the same time, I'm always reminded that what comes with new technologies, new service, new ideas, also comes with new jobs. I imagine for things like the smart grid, there will be new jobs created through manufacturing, things like power lines, new power lines, you know, heavy power inducing power lines that can link up deserts in Mongolia with underwater power lines that reach up to Japan and South Korea, you know. So that kind of thing will happen. We need people who can manufacture high-tech devices in labs and new types of semiconductors, system on chips. All this kind of stuff will matter. And those will also create jobs. At the same time, while I'm saying this, there is, of course, an unprecedented level of economic inequality that is growing in the OECD developed countries. And for many people, this has a lot to do with, amongst other things, the automation and robotization of manufacturing and services. How countries cope with this will be a very interesting question. I'm reminded right now of a book by McAfee called The Machine Age, I think. Rob McAfee and his co-author, sorry, I can't remember his name, but it was a very interesting book called The Machine Age. And that book talks about the future scenarios for how we cope with this type of machine-driven age. So if anyone's interested, they should definitely go to that book. But yeah, how we cope with it's going to be a very interesting question.
And so finally, how do you see this unfolding? And over what period of time do you see sort of the establishment of these, you know, smart grids so that we can start to move to increasingly renewable energy sources?
I think the Koreans, for instance, their vision was to establish a commercial smart grid by 2030, unless I'm incorrect here. There are plenty of official documents on the internet, so maybe people can refer to those. But yeah, 2030 sounds like
the goal. Koreans use it in their own country as much as they will try to export it?
Oh, absolutely. So one of the big achievements that came about from President Lee Myung-bak, who was the guy who moved Korea onto this green growth footing, one of the first things he did was to launch the world's largest smart grid testbed trial on an island called Jeju Island. So Jeju Island is where people lived. It's a small city anyway, but the island is home to wind power, solar panels, and it was a perfect setting in many ways for the trial. So South Korea led the world's most successful testbed trial for smart grids. It involved companies like IBM, Qualcomm,
and Cisco, I think.
Cisco as well, along with all the Korean companies like, you know, Samsung, LG, and Hyundai and others. So that trial confirmed that, yes, you know, a smart grid is indeed possible. The question now is, how do we commercialize it? How do we get the technologies matured enough to be technologically feasible and affordable? How do we also consider questions about the business case for how smart grids are going to be rolled out? Because that's a very important thing as well. We need competition in the utilities market,
instead of the monopolies that we've had.
Absolutely.
I think that has been one of the fears, too, is having those sort of Enron types of things happen again, which some people argue that could be more likely with some of these smart grids because of the way the technology works. I'm not technologically savvy enough to say whether they have a legitimate fear or if that is unfounded.
Well, there's a lot of discussion about how to reform the utilities market. It's a big thing.
Well, Sun-Young Kim, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much, Maria.
When we come back, we know that the wealthy have more influence than other Americans. But just how unrepresentative is the American Congress and the state legislatures? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Whose interests and policy preferences are represented in the halls of Congress and the state legislatures? And how much has changed over the years? What impacts this? Our next guests have measured this relationship in their research. Three experts join us. Martin Gillens is professor of politics at Princeton University and the author of Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, and Why Americans Hate Welfare, Race, Media, and the Politics of Anti-Poverty Policy. Thomas Hayes also joins us. He is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Connecticut. His publications include Responsiveness in an Era of Inequality, The Case of the U.S. Senate. Patrick Flavin joins us. He is a professor of political science at Baylor University, and his publications include Income Inequality and Policy Representation in the American States. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. All three of you have found generally that the interests of the wealthy are better represented than others in our legislatures. There have been some dramatic words used: plutocracy, gilded age, oligarchic, powerful words. Is it really this dramatic, Martin Gillens?
I'm afraid it is. When I started this project, I expected to find, as I think anyone would, that affluent Americans have more influence over government policy than those who are less well off. But what I didn't expect to find was the really shocking degree to which that's true. And I looked at data over about four decades and found that under most circumstances, what poor people or the middle class prefer as far as government policy goes seems to bear virtually no relationship to what the government actually does.
You did look across policies, and there were some differences depending on which policies you were looking at.
Well, generally speaking, the patterns of inequality that I found seemed to hold in varying degrees across the entire sort of gamut of federal policymaking. So it wasn't just economic policies or policies with sort sort of strongly redistributive components, but, you know, even things, certain aspects of foreign policy or social issues having to do with things like abortion and so on, these kinds of issues also seem to reflect predominantly the influence of the affluent. Now, of course, there are issues on which there's little disagreement across income levels, right? On issues, for example, certain defense issues, aspects of the environment, and so on, where poor people, the middle class, and the well-off tend to agree. Well, on those issues, of course, people at the bottom of the income distribution are just as likely to see their preferences adopted as those at the top, right, by definition. But when the preferences do diverge, then only under very special sort of political circumstances do we really see any substantial influence from the poor or by the poor or the middle class.
Now, before we bring in the other scholars to compare their findings with yours, two other aspects of your book that were really quite interesting. One is that there wasn't very much difference across the parties unless we had strong competition, which we don't usually have in this country. You would expect the Democrats to be more responsive to middle class and poor people. Why this steady sense of who is represented?
Well, I think you're right. That was another surprise in this work, that we did not see policies more reflective of a sort of a broader range of the public or the less well-off, you know, groups among Americans when Democrats were in power, as I would have expected. And I think there's a few reasons. One of them is that both parties over the past few decades have adopted a set of sort of market-oriented policies that are much more popular among the well-off than among the middle class or the poor. And this includes like the sort of deregulatory move in federal policymaking that arguably started with Carter and accelerated under Reagan, but was embraced by Clinton as well. You know, things like, of course, the deregulation of the financial sector, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, more broadly, a move toward a deregulatory environment. Also with trade policy, we see the same thing, a sort of steady move over the last few decades in a direction of a freer trade regime, which is more popular and arguably more beneficial to people at the top of the income distribution. So I think that's one reason, is that the parties are less different than they used to be on a set of important policies where the interests and preferences of Americans differ. And the other reason is that while it's generally true that on other dimensions of economic policy, like tax policy and the minimum wage, the Democrats are more representative of and more aligned with what the middle class and the poor prefer, yet there's a different set of policies, which are these sort of social, moral, religious kinds of policies, where it's actually Republicans who are more consistent with the typically more conservative views of low-income Americans. So things like abortion, school prayer, gay rights, on these kinds of issues, we actually see a different party alignment with regard to economic distribution of preferences.
Those tend to be the more emotional issues. And I think scholars are finding more and more that there are a lot of people that are emotional voters as opposed to rational voters.
Yeah, there's a hot debate about that in political science.
Tom Hayes, let's bring you in. How does this comport with your research? You've looked at the Senate, but you've also looked at how people actually understand these policies.
Sure. So my research is really in line with what Martin's finding. I looked at senator responsiveness to their constituents over about a 10-year period from 2000 to 2010. And generally, my findings were very similar in that senators consistently responded to upper-income constituents, not able to detect any responsiveness to low-income constituents. And this was really consistent no matter which party controlled the Senate or not.
Did you divide the policies up that you looked at as well in the way that Martin Gillens did?
No. My policy, the way that it looks at it, is all votes cast by senators to determine their ideology, their relationship with one another, and how well that matches up with constituency opinion, again, ideologically. And again, there's very consistent results in that in no instance, really any way that I cut the data and ran the results, was I able to find responsiveness to low-income, poor Americans.
Tom, also there was another aspect that I was trying to understand, something that you said about how citizens are not always able to understand the issues as thoroughly. If they truly understood the consequences of the issues, they might respond differently in terms of their preference. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. So there's been decades of research in political science that shows that there's relatively low levels of knowledge among all Americans in terms of political knowledge. And this has been kind of consistent throughout time, that people have really little interest and little knowledge of political affairs. I looked at the relationship between people's views on inequality as well as their views on government spending on different programs like education, retirement, and healthcare. So I looked at to what degree do those match up. And what I found is that there is a correlation, there is a relationship. It's just not a very strong relationship between the two. So that is to say that there is a relationship between people that want the government to spend more on things like healthcare or education. That relationship matches up with their views on inequality. They want the government to do something to reduce inequality. But it's a very weak relationship, and it's not a relationship that is strong enough perhaps to propel elected officials to act to reduce this growing inequality that we've seen.
And Pat Flavin, let's bring you in now. You've looked at this specifically in the state legislatures, found something kind of similar. How different do the states respond to their constituencies than the Congress?
So thanks for having us. So I found the results very similar to what Tom and Martin found at the national level, and that is at the state level, we find the same thing, that upper income constituents are much more likely to see their policy opinions reflected in the policy choices that state legislatures make. And that was true for both the general liberalism of policies, so asking citizens whether they're conservative or liberal, then looking at the kind of general tone of state policies. But it was also true for specific policies, so kind of similar to what Martin did. I looked at the death penalty and opinions on abortion. And for those as well, upper income constituents, their opinions were well reflected in state policies. But for low income constituents, you don't see any relationship. So consistent findings with what the other two gentlemen have found, just looking at a different level of government. So it seems like political inequality, regardless of the level of government that's under consideration, that there's political inequality wherever we look.
Did you divide up the states to see if some were more representative than others?
Well, I think that's the next step in this research area. I think us three and other scholars have pretty well documented that the poor are poorly represented. So I think the next question is, under what conditions are they better represented, or is there more equal representation? So Martin had mentioned that he's looked at the equality of representation under more competitive versus less competitive conditions. I've started to look at institutional fixes or possible fixes. So, for example, if states with more stringent campaign finance laws have more equal representation, if direct democracy, the ballot initiative process, if that can promote greater equality. So I think that's the next step, is to look at, well, why are some states more equal than others? What do they have that the other states don't?
And then maybe even an international comparison. Why do some countries have better representation than others?
Right. If I can jump in here on this question, Martin Gillens here. You know, I think Patrick's exactly right. Looking at these sorts of institutional factors is the next step in this kind of research. But one thing that I was able to look at just at the national level was the role of impending elections. And that was one ray of hope in the findings in my project, in as much as during periods of especially presidential elections, the periods leading up to presidential elections, we do see a greater consistency between government policies and the preferences of the public, and a somewhat more equal responsiveness to people in the middle or at the bottom of the economic spectrum. So there's never really a period where the middle class has as much influence as the affluent, or the poor as much as the middle class, but nevertheless, you do see some responsiveness to those less well-off groups in presidential election years that you don't see in other years of the electoral cycle.
One of the other things that I gathered from your book is that this has been getting progressively worse. Would you say that's the case?
Well, you know, when I started this work, I had expected to find that during the 1960s, which is the earliest period that I collected data for, that there would have been sort of golden age, or at least a more equal responsiveness to the preferences of the middle class and the poor under those conditions. So I looked at the Johnson administration, a period of very strong democratic control. Unions, of course, were stronger in those days. Inequality, economic inequality was less. And so I was expecting to find a strong responsiveness during that period, or at least a stronger responsiveness to a broader spectrum of the public, and then thinking maybe that has declined over time. But in fact, I never found that. There never was a period that showed any kind of consistent responsiveness to the less well-off. However, it does appear from my data that responsiveness to the affluent has grown over time.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Martin Gillens, Pat Flavin, and Tom Hayes about just how much influence the affluent have on the American lawmaking process. So who were they responsive to in the past if they weren't being responsive necessarily to the poor? Maybe is it just that the middle class had more say?
No, that doesn't appear to be the case, at least during the Johnson years. So I think there was a lesson that I took away from the analysis of that period, which is that when there's dominant party control, that you don't really get responsiveness to the public at all. That what you get is parties adopting their own priorities and responding to their own sort of core constituencies, their own interest groups and funders and so on. And that's what we saw during the Johnson years in the mid-1960s, where some of the policies were, in fact, strongly supported by the less well-off. You know, the Great Society, of course, you know, comes to mind as a prominent policymaking during those years. But other policies were not, and things like the loosening of immigration laws in the 1960s were very unpopular with the public and extremely unpopular with lower-income Americans. And yet that was a Democratic Party priority that they were able to enact because of the very strong control that they have of the government. So I think that there may have been other periods that I didn't look at, but at least the data that I have didn't ever show any period of strong responsiveness to the middle class or the poor. But as I said, it did seem to show a gradually increasing responsiveness to the affluent.
Tom Hayes?
Sure. I think that I have something that is very similar. So I looked at the 107th Congress, which was right in 2001, and it's an interesting case because right in the middle of this congressional session, a Republican senator decides to switch parties. Senator Jim Jeffords, a Republican, switches to be an independent, but he caucuses with the Democrats. And so it allows us to look at a period in which Republicans control the Senate, the agenda, to one in which the Democrats, right in the middle of this congressional session, get to take over. And what I found is that when the Democrats took over, actually overall responsiveness to the wealthy increases. And also, in one of the congressional sessions that I looked at was the period in which the Senate was controlled by the Democrats, and this is right when Barack Obama becomes president. And again, even in that Congress, I find responsiveness very consistently to upper-income Americans.
One thing that, Martin Gillens, you started to talk about here and you also talked about in your book is the role of interest groups and how in some cases these interest groups do represent the interests of the very wealthy, but in some cases they're acting like a great equalizer in terms of who is represented.
Sure. I guess I'd say there's two ways that interest groups kind of work to benefit the interests or preferences of the less well-off. And one is that there are some groups who are sort of focused on issues that are beneficial to middle class or to low-income Americans. And those, of course, would include unions, which play sort of a broad role, although a much smaller role now than they did decades ago in influencing federal policy, but unions and perhaps even organizations like the AARP. But in addition to that, there are other groups, business groups, where at least on particular issues, their preferences, the kinds of policies that they are lobbying for, are actually more consistent with what low-income or middle-income Americans prefer. And the reason for that is that business interests in Washington tend to, on the one hand, advocate lower taxes, but on the other hand, advocate greater government spending on the issues that they care about. So we've got a massive healthcare industry, for example, that's pushing in Washington for greater government spending on healthcare. Well, that is a policy that works to the benefit and gets more support from the middle class and the poor than from the affluent. So in those kinds of cases, you do see, I think, a coincidence of interests or preferences between interest groups and less well-off Americans, despite the fact that those interest groups are not pursuing those policies because it helps the less well-off. They're pursuing them because it helps their particular industries.
And you did not look, as I recall from your book, at some of the interest groups that people might think of as more public interest groups, some of the environmental organizations, some of the public citizens of the world. You didn't look at their role at all in this.
That's correct. I just looked at 43 groups that were identified in surveys of sort of Washington insiders as the most powerful interest organizations in Washington.
Okay.
That did not include, it did include things like the AARP and unions and so on, but it did not include some of those smaller, more public interest-oriented groups.
And what's interesting about your work over time, too, is the fact that unions have lost power and lost membership, and yet the trend seems to continue as opposed to drastically change in one direction.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Pat Flavin, do you see any of this relationship also on the state level?
Yeah, I think the states, from a research perspective, the nice thing about it is that we have 50 of them, and so they vary sometimes pretty dramatically in how they approach politics, how they set up their laws and their institutions. And so where Martin looked at how things have ebbed and flowed over time, that's one way to kind of look at what factors cause more or less inequality. And another way is to look at, well, across the state, how do we see certain institutions lining up? So I had mentioned before campaign finance laws. There's concern at the national level about the Citizens United decision and how that might affect elections. It might be too early to tell, given that the decision isn't too far out. But at the state level, we can see all sorts of variation, because some states have very strict limits. Some states have public financing systems. Some states have no limits. So we can look at, well, do those states where a single individual could bankroll a candidate, do we see more unequal representation there? And some research that I've done suggests, yes, that places where laws are very lax, there's basically very little control over campaign finance, that the poor are especially poorly represented in those particular states. I think the states also provide a great way to look at this problem and hopefully to come up with some possible recommendations or solutions on making things a little more equal.
You looked primarily, you said, at the social issues more than fiscal issues.
Right. And earlier research that I had done, when I broke it out by specific issues, I did look at social issues, which I think is interesting. I think it mirrors what Martin had said, that you see this interesting trend in public opinion where on economic issues, the rich are more conservative than the poor, as we might expect. But on social issues, gay marriage, abortion, et cetera, it's actually flipped, where the poor tend to be more conservative and the wealthier folks tend to be more liberal. So you might expect, if policy was, say, uniformly trending conservatively, that the poor would win on some issues and not on others. But that's not what I find at the state level, and that's not what Martin finds at the national level either, that it's, whether it's economic issues or it's moral or social issues, the preferences of the poor don't get much representation. They don't seem to get reflected in what the decisions that policymakers make.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Martin Gillens, Pat Flavin, and Tom Hayes about just how much influence the affluent have on the American lawmaking process. Do you think now, looking at this, stepping back, that this is driven primarily by interest groups and campaign contributions, which come from interest groups and wealthy people? Or does it perhaps come from the fact that people who are in office tend to be wealthier? Or does it come from perhaps the fact that people are not very well informed and their preferences sometimes don't reflect what's necessarily better for them in their lives? Martin Gillens, you talked about this in your book. What's your take on this?
I guess I'd say that it does not result from a lack of information. It's true that people who have lower incomes on average are somewhat less informed about politics, but even people, you know, with the top of the income distribution on average are not particularly knowledgeable about the details of public policy. And most of the cases where the poor are sort of viewed as not having sort of the real understanding of what their true interests are cases where they agree with affluent Americans when people think they really shouldn't. So things like support for the elimination of the inheritance tax or support for the Bush tax cuts are examples of this. But, of course, what we're finding in our work, all three of us, is that that would suggest you'd see more responsiveness to the preferences of the poor than you actually do. So that, I don't think, is the reason. And I think interest groups are also not really the main factor here. And there's just too many cases where the interest group universe as a whole does not align with what affluent Americans want. And we talked about some of the examples earlier. And a third factor, which I think we can rule out, is the greater political participation of middle-class or affluent Americans, right? So sometimes when I present this work, people will say, well, yes, but poor people don't turn out to vote, so of course they have less influence. But it turns out that middle-class Americans vote and participate in politics in other ways at almost the same levels as those with high incomes. And yet the discrepancies in the amount of influence they have is vast. So I don't think that kind of participation really can explain it. So what does that leave? That leaves money. And, you know, the old adage about money being the mother's milk of politics, you know, I think this is just the expression of that in policymaking, that we see the people who are contributing the dollars to campaigns, to interest, you know, parties and interest organizations, these are the people whose preferences, lo and behold, are reflected in policy outcomes.
And Tom Hayes?
I wholeheartedly agree that donations absolutely play a role. And something that I would add to that is that, you know, the working class are not really very well represented in the legislature. And there's work by Nicholas Carnes at Duke University that supports this idea that really throughout American history, we don't see members of the legislature coming from these working class backgrounds that they might be more likely to identify with and understand kind of the plight of the poor. I think it's important that in all of our research, what we're looking at is that legislators and public officials oftentimes have a choice in who they can respond to, whether it's the wealthy or the poor, because oftentimes those preferences diverge, not always, but often. And what we're consistently finding is that always this siding with the affluent.
Pat Flavin?
I agree, you know, with Tom and Martin. I think they hit on the two big ones, and that is lower class folks are just not well represented in government. Nicholas Carnes, the scholar that Tom mentioned, has a great book about that that shows that people from working class backgrounds are virtually non-existent in state legislatures and in Congress. You know, the Senate's often referred to as a millionaire's club. I think there's a lot of truth to that. So I think that's one possibility, is that there aren't working class or low-income folks in government to represent those interests. And then the second, I totally agree with Martin, it's the role of money in politics. And it seems that we're moving away from regulation or towards less regulation, and you know, my concern with that would be that that's going to lead to even more unequal representation, that if we wanted to equalize things or give everyone's opinion a fair shot, that we should be looking to try to lessen the influence of money. But right now it seems we're working in the opposite direction.
Given that where the Supreme Court has landed on campaign finance and equating it with free speech, a lot of scholars think that money should not be equated with speech. But where are the potential reforms if you want to have a truly representative government? Martin Gillens, what would you say?
Well, I think the current climate is quite challenging in that regard, as you suggested. You know, there is some room, and states have attempted to take advantage of that even within existing campaign finance laws for things like public financing that involve voluntary commitments to limits on expenditures, or in some cases even responses to third-party spending, such as we saw recently in Massachusetts. But it's not clear whether, you know, within the current legal framework, whether we can sort of come up with effective campaign regulations. You know, people talk about campaign regulation as being kind of like squeezing a balloon, where you squeeze one place and it comes out in another. So I think it is a huge challenge. Now, on the other hand, you know, the Citizens United decision was a 5-4 decision, and one might hope that some future Supreme Court that's, you know, more amenable to campaign finance, we might see some shift. But that's a slim read, I think, to hold our hopes on.
Tom Hayes?
Well, I agree that the current political climate would be very difficult to see a lot of these reforms that might change the system. Although, you know, I don't think that it's insurmountable or impossible. If we think about other periods of inequality in American history, whether it's income inequality or racial inequality, we see reaction by the public. And when the public does put a lot of pressure on elected officials for changes, oftentimes we can see these very entrenched institutions be changed and be more responsive to what the public wants. There's the progressive response to the First Gilded Age and other times in American history in which the government instituted reforms.
You bring up something that I meant to bring up earlier, which is the issue of race within this equation. Is that something that you have looked at in terms of the racial inequalities and representation? Pat Flavin?
Right, and I can give a quick summary of some findings that I've had on previous research for racial inequality, and there you see the same type of inequality that African Americans and Hispanics, their preferences are less likely to be represented. Basically, if you think about groups that we traditionally think as disadvantaged in American politics, I think the work of all three of us has shown that those groups' opinions really aren't that well reflected. So it kind of, we had that inclination, and I think our work has helped to show that. So I would just give a plug to this program and the work that we're doing and others that is finally really calling attention to this and calling attention to the fact that there's growing income inequality and growing political inequality. I think Tom's exactly right that for something to change or for remedies to happen, people have to know it's happening. And so I think that's some small role that we as scholars can play is calling attention to this, and that this radio program can do as well, calling attention to this issue and just informing people that inequality is growing, and if we want to do something about it, we should start thinking seriously about it.
Thank you, Martin Gillens, Pat Flavin, Tom Hayes. Appreciate you sharing your research with us and joining us. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
Martin Gillens is professor of politics at Princeton University and the author of Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, and Why Americans Hate Welfare, Race, Media, and the Politics of Anti-Poverty Policy. Thomas Hayes is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Connecticut. His publications include Responsiveness in an Era of Inequality, The Case of the U.S. Senate. Patrick Flavin is a professor of political science at Baylor University. His publications include Income Inequality and Policy Representation in the American States. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Armudian. See you next week.